Welcome to The Excellent Fiduciary, a podcast from Roland Criss, where we explore what it takes to meet and exceed the demands of managing a retirement plan in today's complex market. Now, let's begin today's show with an introduction from our Roland Criss host.
Over the past few years, executives and managers in all industry sectors have asked us a variety of questions related to fiduciary practices. This podcast is a collection of inquiries that we've received, arranged by major topics that appear most frequently in our inbox. Hi, I'm Ron Hagen. I'm chairman of Roland Criss's Risk Standards Committee. In the two decades I've been coaching, consulting, and writing about the operational and risk management challenge facing fiduciary individuals, my inbox has received thousands of inquiries, and none are more interesting to me than those from professional fiduciaries, that is, executives and human resources managers who populate oversight committees for employee benefit plans. Over the years, I've received some really fascinating and perplexing questions, and what follows is a sampling of the most often recurring issues that stimulate inquiries into my inbox. So let's proceed. The first one is it necessary to form a committee to oversee a retirement plan? The rules that define the conduct standards for individuals who manage their employer's retirement plans don't mandate the formation of a committee. The growing complexity, though, of managing 401k, 403b, and defined benefit type plans, though, has led to widespread adoption by prudent enterprises of an oversight by committee approach. Employers have come to realize that a team made up of internal managers and outside experts has the best chance of satisfying all of the disciplines embedded within ERISA's fiduciary duty. Those can be summarized in four categories: governance, administration, investments, and controls. A high level of proficiency in these skills is really vital, and a properly established and functioning fiduciary committee ensures that each discipline receives its proper focus, that information gaps are closed, the risk of lawsuits and regulatory fines is reduced, plan participant needs receive timely attention, and the costs of the services charged by vendors don't outweigh the benefits of their services. Another question that's frequently occurring in my inbox is, what range of topics should a fiduciary committee be expected to address? Well, a committee, first of all, should have an internal code of procedures, or what we like to call a workflow or a framework, a governance framework. Those procedures should be defined in a committee charter. A charter determines a committee's roles and responsibilities, its purpose, its structure, its duties, and standard protocols. For example, many employers are choosing to delegate the role of the plan administrator, as that's defined in the Employee Retirement Income Security Act, to their fiduciary committee. And the committee charter in those cases will acknowledge that a delegation of that heavy duty of legal responsibility has taken place. A charter should also define the limitation of the committee's powers. Where are the governance rules for ERISA plans found, I'm often asked? Well, ERISA requires that every employee benefit plan be established and maintained according to a written instrument. That's the so-called plan document. ERISA also requires that the rules for operating a qualified plan are communicated to employees, to the plan's participants. So a summary of that document, or a summary plan description, describes the details of the plan, and that must be distributed to participants within 90 days of their becoming a participant. So the governance rules for ERISA plans are found in the plan document that's adopted at the creation of the plan. Governance, risk management, and compliance is another new issue that's emerged in the past couple of years that deals with the embracing topic of compliance with fiduciary best practices, as well as actual standard statutes and regulations. A GRC system has a number of significant benefits to it. First of all, it increases the plan's performance. It brings a focus to the fiduciary oversight. It improves the administrative burden on human resources staff by creating an integrated and cohesive approach that deal with the operational issues that are embedded within retirement plan administration. How do fiduciaries prove that they select and monitor their vendors prudently is another question I'm often asked. Well, hiring and properly supervising vendors of services to ERISA plans are fiduciary acts, and they're governed by the duty of what's called prudence and loyalty, establishing and implementing a process to ensure the proper selection and monitoring of vendors is a critical step toward reducing regulatory problems. The Employee Benefits Security Administration, which enforces ERISA, acknowledges that dealing with vendors can be complex and risky. It's complex due to confusing jargon and interlocking vendor relationships. Oftentimes, a key vendor or a primary vendor has affiliates or subsidiary companies that provide certain components of the service delivery, and that makes evaluating vendor performance and, in fact, fees somewhat complex. It's a risky business, too, because plan fiduciaries are at a major information disadvantage against their vendors. Vendors are specialists in the design of their products, their services, and their compensation arrangements. And executives that buy from these vendors don't have the vendor's degree of specialization. So what's the result? Well, vendors have a critical information advantage over their clients. What's the solution? We recommend that fiduciaries, no less frequently than every 3 years, operate a request for proposal project requiring vendors to step forward and update the plan sponsor with an understanding of their services, fees, and liability protections. Here's a question that is occurring more frequently. It has to do with payroll. The question is a payroll processing vendor a co-fiduciaries? Vendors that provide purely administrative services for ERISA-qualified plans fall into a category called ministerial service providers. As such, they're not plan fiduciaries. Now, examples include record-keeping firms, organization process claims for benefits, such as a third-party administrator, those that distribute participant notices and other plan communications, preparation of necessary governmental forms like Form 5500 are all examples of ministerial functions. Now, although payroll is a ministerial function and is not therefore a fiduciary activity, the point at which a retirement plan and a payroll system intersect is a breeding ground for the most common violations of fiduciary duty, and they can be the most unwieldy to fix. We've conducted hundreds of ERISA plan operations assessments which span several industries, and they reveal six major payroll deficiencies that trigger fiduciary duty violations. And here's the list. Definition of compensation, matching contributions, elective deferrals, participant loans, hardship distributions, and timely deposits of deferrals, that is, the contributions that participants make to their retirement plans, are all the major categories of difficulty, all stimulated by the interaction of payroll with a retirement plan. This question has to do with an investment issue. It's, why is a qualified default investment alternative important? Well, ERISA plans that offer a qualified default investment alternative, or a QDIA, reduce the fiduciary risk associated with employees who auto-enroll or fail to make their own investment choices. Now, regulations require that a QDIA can either be a target date fund, a balanced fund, a mutual fund, or an account managed by a professional money manager. The evaluation of QDIA options must be approached differently from the analysis used in connection with a single asset class mutual fund, though. For example, and notwithstanding the retirement plan industry's push toward target date funds as the predominant QDIA, there are scenarios in which a risk-based fund may be more appropriate than a target date fund. So before evaluating the specifics of any QDIA strategy, the process should embrace all QDIA options in order to demonstrate prudence in the selection decision, and be sure you document the steps you took to make the QDIA choice. Now, that raises up another question, which is often asked. How can a fiduciary know if a particular investment is a prudent choice for a retirement plan? ERISA determines whether an investment selected for inclusion in a qualified plan was selected based upon relevant facts and circumstances. ERISA does not declare any investment to be prudent or unwise. ERISA requires fiduciaries, though, to act in the sole interest of the plan's participants and to behave in the same circumstances as a prudent person would. Importantly, fiduciaries are not accountable for any particular investment return. Instead, fiduciaries are responsible for managing a prudent process. So the fact of the matter is that defined contribution committees, often called investment committees, don't really make investment choices. Investment committees of 401k and 403b type plans actually manage an investment decision-making process. And the key choice they make, typically, has to do with the selection of investment managers, mutual fund companies. Those are the people who actually make investment decisions. So it can be misleading to think of an investment committee as one that's actually making investment choices and bears the responsibility for the outcome of their investment decisions from a performance standpoint. That couldn't be further from the truth. Now, the selection and monitoring of investments requires the ability to evaluate complex investment securities markets and understand the jargon and the reporting techniques of mutual fund companies. Training and education for fiduciary committee members on the basics of investments is a vital requirement anytime an individual is added to a fiduciary committee. The subject of internal control comes up frequently, particularly at the end of the annual plan audit period, when retirement plan auditors submit their reports to management and oftentimes have a discussion about internal control in those audits. So this question has to do with that issue. What are examples of internal control procedures for ERISA plans, this particular fiduciary asks? Well, fiduciaries who don't meet the basic standards of behavior may be personally liable to recover any damage to the plan or to restore any gains made as a result of their abuse of the plan's resources. So good internal control reduces the risk of loss and helps ensure that the plan data is complete, activities of the program are carried out in compliance with relevant laws and regulations. And here are a few of the most frequently appearing internal control procedures that Roland Chris sees among the plans for which we conduct operations risk assessments. I'll just list them for you. First of all, the internal control procedure will compare salary deferral election forms with the amounts deducted from employees' wages on a payroll-to-payroll basis. Verification of the types of compensation used for allocations, deferrals, and testing is made. A verification that plan service providers received accurate compensation and ownership records is vital. This is a situation that can create garbage in, garbage out, because the record keeper, which is the primary plan service provider, unknowing of changes in compensation, is going to make decisions and create transactions that are based upon faulty information. The monitoring of annual contribution and compensation limits is vital. The internal control system should also verify the validity of rollover contributions to a plan. Verification of years of service, that they were accurately determined for eligibility investing, is vital. And the verification of marital status and spousal consent for plan distributions is critical. This question is important. Are fiduciary committees at less risk if they hire lowest cost vendors? And there's a tendency in the marketplace right now to go hire lowest cost vendors because of the reputation that litigation cases are creating, where plan sponsors are being sued for paying excessive compensation to vendors. But the fact is, that compliance with ERISA changed dramatically when the U.S. Department of Labor released Regulation 408B2. This is the so-called reasonable fee rule. That regulation insists that planned fiduciaries arrange services with third-party vendors that are appropriate. Not lowest cost, but they're appropriate. In other words, there needs to be a balance between the services delivered and the compensation paid. Merely selecting the lowest cost provider is not the answer. As a matter of fact, in many cases, low-cost providers are going to deliver low level of service. So a proper balance needs to be struck between level of service and fees paid for those services. In the vast majority of cases that we see in conducting our retirement plan assessments throughout the industry, we do see, however, a dangerous disregard for the growth in compensation, particularly when it's asset-based pricing, where vendors continue to receive increases annually in their compensation without any changes whatsoever in their services they're delivering. So this is an area of great concern and one that should demand a significant amount of attention from every fiduciary committee. Well, that's a collection of the most recent significant questions, most frequently occurring questions that I receive in my inbox, and I wanted to share those with you today. If you have questions that we've not covered today, please feel free to send me an email at excellentfiduciary@rolandchris.com, and I will faithfully respond to your question just as soon as I receive it. Well, thank you for joining our podcast today, and come back again next week. And until then, have a great day.